Let's move on into chapter 7. Now, chapter 7 is really where it's Isaiah's efforts to encourage King Ahaz. And it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, we gave that little genealogy a few minutes ago, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, went up toward Jerusalem to war against it, but could not prevail against it. Now what he's simply saying is that while Ahaz was the king of Judah, Pekah, the king of Israel, made an alliance with Rezin, the king of Syria, to come down and make war against him. They went up toward Jerusalem to make war against it, but could not prevail. And it was told the house of David, saying, Syria is confederate with Ephraim. Ephraim is another word for Israel. And when we speak of Ephraim, we're speaking of Israel. And so, the house of David, which would be Judah, they were told, apparently, miraculously by God, they were told that Syria has made a confederation with Ephraim. And his heart was moved, and the heart of his people, as the trees of the wood are moved with the wind. I think he's still talking about Ephraim here. That is when Ephraim got a chance to make an alliance with a foreign nation against Judah, while his heart was moved like the leaves of the trees are moved with the wind. He just tossed around anyway. The first thing that comes along that looks good, he's going to take it. And this reminds me in Ephesians, the 4th chapter, where he says that we'll not be tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine. Let us not be unstable. The Bible says that a double-minded man is unstable in all of his ways. Let's not be unstable, ready to just grasp at the first new thing that comes along. But Ephraim was, Israel was. And so they made a confederation with a foreign nation of Syria against their fellow kinsman, Judah. Then said the Lord unto Isaiah, Go forth now to meet Ahaz, thou, and Shurjasub thy son. And this word Shurjasub means a remnant shall remain. At the end of the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fuller's field. So he's given Isaiah specific instructions of where to meet the man and where to talk to him, Ahaz. And say unto him, Take heed and be quiet. Now here's the thing for Ahaz to do. And sometimes when we're in a time of stress and trouble, we don't know quite which way to turn. This would be the best advice we could ever have. Take heed and be quiet. Just calm down, first of all. Be calm and take heed. Pay attention. In other words, just sit back and listen. Take heed and be quiet. Fear not, neither be faint-hearted, for the two tails of these smoking firebrands, for the fierce anger of Rezin with Syria and of the son of Remaliah. He calls them, the two tails of these smoking firebrands. A firebrand is a coal, as I understand it, that would go sailing along and land and leave a little trail of smoke behind it. The smoke would be the tail of the firebrand. And so this Syria and Israel is just like a little fire sending up some smoke. Don't be afraid of them. Don't be faint-hearted. Because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliah have taken evil counsel against thee, saying, Let us go up against Judah, and vex it, and let us make a breach therein for us, and to set a king in the midst of it, even the son of Tabriel. I looked up the word Tabriel, and Young says that Tabriel was a person whose son was going to be set over the kingdom of Judah by the king of Syria and the king of Israel. So that's exactly what he says here. So there is no other definition of it. We don't know who this man was, other than that his son, whenever they conquered Judah, they were going to put his son up to be the king of it. Now we learn another lesson from this, which is not said in so many words, but it's certainly taught very plainly, and that is it's God who removes and sets up the kings. And regardless of what Israel and Syria wanted to do, until God got ready for the king to change down there at Judah, it wasn't going to happen. And we have a kind of a paradox here. On the one hand, God is threatening Judah. He says, I'm going to take the kingdom away from you. I'm going to take you out of this land. I'm going to leave it desolate. And yet on the other hand, he says, there's a couple of nations up here that are wanting to take you over and wanting to ruin you, and I'm not going to let it happen. Now, you might say, well, God, why? If you're going to ruin them anyway, why not just let these two nations go ahead and get the job done? That wasn't the way God wanted it. So on the one hand, he was staunchly protecting them, and on the other hand, he was staunchly threatening them with ruin, because the ruin would come at his way and by his means, and not as a result of this threat from Israel and Syria. Thus saith the Lord God, it shall not stand, neither shall it come to pass. Now whatever they decide to do, it's not going to happen. It'll not come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is reason. And within 65 years shall Ephraim be broken, and there shall not be a people. Now, according to history, about 20 years after this attack, Ephraim was carried away, for the most part, into captivity, but there was some of the people left. But according to this same history, 65 years after this, another man, Esarhaddon, came in and took the rest of the people. That's when Ephraim then was really broken, and there didn't seem to be any remnant of his kingdom left. There was no government, there was no kingdom left at the 65-year period. So this is quite an astounding prophecy here. And said that it'll be broken, that it shall not be a people. It'll be not a people. Even though there might have been some left, there were not a people. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son, who was Pekah. If ye will not believe, surely ye shall not be established. And so he's telling Ahaz, if you don't believe what I'm telling you, you're not going to last either. If you don't take the lesson that's to be taught by Israel's mistake, you will not last either. Believe what I'm telling you. Now, beginning in the 10th verse, we get into a very difficult portion of the prophecy. Moreover, the Lord spake unto Ahaz, saying, ask thee a sign of the Lord thy God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. So he told Ahaz, as a further proof now of my fidelity, and that what I'm telling you is the truth, I'd like for you to ask for a sign. You can ask for a sign that would even be from the heaven or in the heavens above, or you can ask for a sign that would come from the depths, which the word here means the grave. One from the grave or one from the heavens. Ask for a sign. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, neither will I tempt the Lord. Now you may wonder, why did Ahaz make a statement like that? And as I read and reread and reread this passage and try to fit the parts, the thought that comes to me is that he probably made this statement because he didn't want any proof. He didn't want the Lord to tell him really what he had to do and how he had to change in order to be saved. And so he said, I don't want to tempt the Lord. And you know, you hear people and see people today who say, well, the Bible is a real good book and I believe it, but I just don't believe anybody can understand it. Anybody who says, I don't believe anybody can understand it, you better believe that's a person who is not studying the Bible. They're not interested in studying. And this is their out for not studying. So Ahaz said, yeah, Lord, I take what you say. I don't want to tempt you by asking for a sign. Well, the Lord already told him to ask for a sign. And he said, hear ye now, O house of David. This is the Lord speaking back now to Ahaz. Is it a small thing for you to weary men, but will you weary my God also? Ahaz, you're being difficult. You can play around with men like this on this play of words, but don't treat God this way. Don't weary God. God told you to ask for a sign, and now you refuse to ask for it. What's this doing to God? It's as though somebody wanted to do a little favor, and somebody says, oh, but I don't want to bother you. Ahaz told God, God, I don't want to bother you for any sign. Don't trouble yourself about me. Well, that's what it's all about. Therefore, the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Now, he's going to give the sign, which on the surface seems to be relatively simple, but as we look at it, it's not so simple. And it's had many interpretations and many applications made. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. Now the word Emmanuel here means God with us. Butter and honey shall he eat, that he may know how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that thou abhorrest shall be forsaken of both her kings. Now that is a difficult prophecy. Now we have some help, though, from the Bible. There's a lot of talking about this. One school says that this prophecy has to do with Isaiah's children, and that the word virgin doesn't really mean virgin, it just means a young woman. And so it's really Isaiah's children, but that it's also fulfilled by Christ later on, but there's a fulfillment now by Isaiah. And they quote over here from Isaiah 8, verse 18, it says, Behold, I and the children whom the Lord hath given me are the signs and for wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts which dwelleth in Mount Zion. Then they go on over to the 9th chapter, verse 6, For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be on his shoulders, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, and so forth. And there are long, lengthy dissertations, and Mr. Clark has some of them here that are taking that viewpoint. But as we look in Matthew 1, verse 23, and see what inspiration says about this, verse 21 says, She shall bring forth a son, thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. This is Matthew 1. Now all this was done that it might be fulfilled which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, Behold, a virgin shall be with child, and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which being interpreted is God with us. So Matthew says that this prophecy given in Isaiah was fulfilled in the bringing forth of the Son by the Virgin, which was Mary, and who was named Emmanuel, or that is God with us. So Matthew tells us that this verse 14 was fulfilled with the coming of Christ. We see that a virgin shall conceive. No other place did this ever happen. There was no other fulfillment of this. A virgin shall conceive. Because it means that a woman is able to bring forth a child without the involvement of any man. No man involved. And bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. Now, no other time have we had any being on this earth who could be said to be God with us, because it implies that God came from his abode in the heavenly place and came here and reincarnated as a human being in the earthly place. God with us. So there's no other fulfillment of it. But as we begin to look, butter and honey shall he eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. some interpret it this way, that butter, or the revised, I mean the American Standard says curds, which would mean about the same thing. Butter and honey were foods that were eaten in a productive and peaceful land. You know, we have a saying in this country, whenever the Congress is trying to appropriate money, do they spend it on the needs of the country, or do they spend it on the military hardware, and they decide, is it going to be for guns or for butter? What are we going to spend the money for, guns or butter? We can do without butter in times of war, they reason, but we can't do without guns. And, you know, back during World War II, we had to do without butter. And that's whenever margarine came into the picture so great. But butter and honey shall he eat. Well, some interpret it this way, that, well, he's going to eat the products of a peaceful land. And instead of saying that he may know to refuse the evil, the word really should be when he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. And in other words, whenever he knows to refuse evil and to choose good, then the land is going to be a peaceful land. The land that does good is going to have butter and honey for the child to eat, when he knows to do good and refuse evil. And the implication is that if he does not refuse the evil, then the butter and honey is going to be taken, and he wouldn't be able to eat it. And they further say in verse 16, for before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that thou abhorrest shall be forsaken of both her kings. That is, before this child has a chance to grow to the age to make a determination between what's good and what's bad, why, these two kings that are threatening you up here are not going to any longer be there to threaten you. They won't even, the threat won't even last long enough for the child to grow up. The threat will be taken away. Now that's one interpretation of this, but it probably is not really the right interpretation. Because as we said from the beginning, this is talking about Christ. And Matthew says that the prophecy was talking about Christ. And we don't see its fulfillment any other place other than in Christ. And so when he says, butter and honey shall he eat, this very well may mean that he's going to be a man. And he's going to partake of the things that other men have to partake of in order to be here. He has to eat butter and honey. He was hungry and he had to eat. His body required sustenance. That he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good would mean that he had to grow up like a child, grow up like any other human being would, before he could get to that age of accountability in which he could know to choose the good and refuse the evil. Before he could get into even the mature enough state to be able to make a choice between good and evil. That's the kind of a person he would be. He would be God with us, all right, but he would also be a man, partaking of all of the things that man has to partake of just to grow to a state of maturity. And even then, he would refuse the evil and choose the good because of what he knew, knowledge. Knowledge is the necessary ingredient for our being able to know what's good and what's evil. You show me a person without knowledge, and I'll show you a person who cannot choose the good and refuse the evil. But that person necessarily will be involved in the evil, whether they even know what evil is or not. Knowledge is the key. Now, how many times do we have this well-known fact keep coming up through the Bible? Knowledge. Know something. Get some facts. Know how to apply them. Knowledge is the key. It's by knowledge that we can have all things that pertain to life and godliness, according to Peter. Now, that's a very broad area. All things that pertain to life and godliness. Not only can we have the things in this life, but the things in the life to come. And so even our Savior wasn't just led here as some robot or some kind of a zombie. He had a knowledge. He attained to the age of maturity so that he could discern between good and evil. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that thou abhorrest shall be forsaken of both her kings. Now that part of it there is quite likely more just the literal part that applied to the situation of Ahaz in that it was going to be just a short time before these two kings would be taken away. Now, I'd like to read a little bit here from what Mr. Clark says on this passage, because I don't think that it's one that we should really take very lightly, and yet all that I'm going to say about it is going to be rather lightly when we see what all has been said by other writers about it. I'm not going to read near all that he said, but let me read a few paragraphs. He says, at the time referred to, the kingdom of Judah, under the government of Ahaz, was reduced very low. Pekah, the king of Israel, had slain in Judah 120,000 persons in one day and carried away captives 200,000, including women and children, together with much spoil. To add to their distress, Rezin, the king of Syria, being confederate with Pekah, had taken Elath, a fortified city of Judah, and carried the inhabitants away captive to Damascus. In this critical conjecture, need we wonder what Ahaz was afraid, or that Ahaz was afraid that the enemies who were now united against him must prevail and destroy Jerusalem and end the kingdom of Judea and annihilate the family of David? To meet and to remove this fear, apparently well-grounded, Isaiah is sent from the Lord to Ahaz, swallowed up now both by sorrow and by unbelief, in order to assure him that the counsels of his enemies should not stand and that they should be utterly discomfited. To encourage Ahaz, he commands him to ask a sign or a miracle, which should be a pledge in hand that God should in due time fulfill the predictions of his servant as related in the context. Now, he goes on and makes a lot of detail to explain what is meant here as this relates to Christ. But I want to skip some of that and go on over here to his conclusion. Hence, a virgin shall bear a son is the very spirit and meaning of the original text, independently of the illustration given by the prophet. And the fact recorded by the evangelist is the proof of the whole. But how could that be a sign to Ahaz, which was to take place so many hundreds of years after? Now here's the question I want to answer. How could it be a sign to Ahaz? How could it help Ahaz in his plight whenever he told him something that was going to happen hundreds of years afterwards? How could it help Ahaz to be a sign for him right then and there? I answer, the meaning of the prophet is plain. Not only Rezin and Pekah should be unsuccessful against Jerusalem at that time, which was the fact, he just said it was not so, it couldn't happen, but Jerusalem, Judea, and the house of David should be both preserved, notwithstanding their depressed state and the multitude of their adversaries, till the time should come when a virgin should bear a son. What he's really telling Ahaz is that Judah is not going to cease to be. The stock will always remain, there'll always be that seed, always be that remnant, until there comes a time when a virgin bears a son. So Ahaz could say very plainly, well, it hadn't happened yet. And it didn't happen during his lifetime. And so he could be assured then that God would not allow this seed of David to become extinct, while these other two nations were going to wipe him out and put another king over him. And it would no longer be the house of David. Now this is a most remarkable circumstance. The house of David could never fail till a virgin should conceive and bear a son, nor did it. But when that incredible and miraculous fact did take place, the kingdom and house of David became extinct. This is an irrefragable confutation of every argument a Jew can offer in vindication for his opposition to the gospel of Christ. Either the prophecy in Isaiah has been fulfilled, or the kingdom and the house of David are yet standing. But the kingdom of David, we know, is destroyed. For where is the man, Jew or Gentile, that can show us a single descendant of David on the face of the earth? The prophecy could not fail. The kingdom and the house of David have failed. The virgin, therefore, must have brought forth her son, and this son is Jesus the Christ. Thus Moses, Isaiah, and Matthew concur, and facts the most unequivocal have confirmed the whole. Behold the wisdom and providence of God. So what he's saying is that it couldn't fall, the house of David couldn't fall till the virgin brought forth a son. And if that hasn't happened, if the virgin hasn't brought forth a son, then the house of David should still be standing today. Someplace there ought to be the house of David. But if she has brought forth a son, then the house of David is not standing. Well, no man today can say that he truly is of the house of David and prove it. It cannot be proved. And so the fact that it has happened proves that the house of David no longer exists, and the fact that the house of David no longer exists proves that it has happened. So it really is a very wonderful prophecy when we look at it in that light. Now, he said that Moses, Isaiah, and Matthew concur. Well, where Moses concurs is in Genesis 3 and 15, Moses says, "The seed of the woman shall bruise the head of the serpent." Now, that's a prophecy about Christ. And it's a prophecy talking about the seed of the woman, which is one of the most emphatic statements about a virgin bringing forth a son, because it says nothing about the seed of the man. This is the seed of the woman. Woman only, woman entirely, without the aid of man, woman seed bruising the head of the serpent, which is Christ and Mary, and another way of saying way back there in Genesis that a virgin would bring forth a son. So truly it is Moses and Isaiah and Matthew who concur in the fulfillment of this prophecy. Well, the clocks are striking all around us, so we'll conclude at that point. Just having skimmed the surface of this prophecy, and then next time, Lord willing, beginning with the 17th verse and proceeding from there. Anybody have any questions or comments on the passage discussed tonight? Well, if not, Lord willing, we'll begin with that 17th verse next time.